This is Power Pivot with Leela Sinha.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Power Pivot, the podcast where we talk about ethics, leadership, power, and community. We're having these conversations out loud in public because power can corrupt, but it doesn't have to be that way. Today's guest is Kimberly Shepherd. She says, as a teen whisperer, I introduce teens and young adults to the options available for their future. I specialize in students who are marginalized, unmotivated, or undermotivated, who have learning differences, or who are struggling to feel seen, heard, and understood. Welcome, Kimberly. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Leela. It's great to be here.
So I thought we would start. You've got some really interesting work going on right now, and I have been I've been privileged to be a little bit backstage for that process. So as we've worked together, I've become really excited about your project. So would you tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, about what you have done, what you've been doing, and then where you're taking your work?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it's very exciting to me. For almost 9 years, I've been working individually with students, many of them students from families who are well-established and very financially comfortable, but also students who are underrepresented students of color. And when I say underrepresented, I mean in higher education, which is sort of the focus of a lot of the work that I've been doing. And also with students whose families are marginalized with their financial challenges. So kind of a two different approaches and two different groups of students that I've worked with for almost 9 years. But those have all been on an individual basis. And what I am moving toward is an opportunity campus space, although not a school, where students, and my idea is students approximately 16 to about 26, when our full brain development has occurred, and who can go to a place and be exposed to the options for their future in one location. I want them to have the ability to touch, feel, see, smell, hear, to sit with options, not just be told, oh, here's something that you could do. You could be an electrician. I want them to actually have a grid, a board that they can work on, a circuit board, so that they know what that feels like. And then I want them to be given support in that process as they're learning about these options for their future, to then say, okay, wow, this really excites me. What do I do next? And for them to have right there in one location that those support systems to move them forward to the next steps.
Yeah, my business coach, Jen Kim, frequently talks about how you need to have that kind of concrete experience of doing something before you know if you want to do it or not. You know, she says, never run a program, a long program or a big program without running a beta first, because you're not just finding out if it's saleable. You're not just testing the market to see if people will engage with what you're offering. You're also testing to see if you want to do it. She says, I piloted some stuff where I did it once and I was like, I don't want to do this. I hate this. I don't want to dread getting up and going to work. If I wanted to do that, I would have stayed in corporate, right?
So true.
And, you know, thinking about especially young people coming into the workforce and really having had no experience of themselves or very limited experience of themselves in a workplace, and not like, how do you know if you're going to like messing around with pipe fittings all day? You don't until you try it.
You don't. And you don't know if you could run your own business. You don't. I mean, what I also want to do is capture students that are not excited about a future. That's something that we don't think a lot about either. You know, there's a lot of students out there, I don't know what I want to do next. And then there's students who say, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do anything next. Because right. The system has left me so behind or so far out that I don't see myself in it anymore. Or maybe I never did.
Yeah. Or like Herb Kohl's concepts from I Won't Learn From You, where he talks about students actively resisting learning in a system that they know is designed to oppress them.
Exactly. Yes.
I think there's...
Yeah, I want this campus environment to provide everything that an individual would need for a given day while they're, you know, being exposed to these various, I call them modules right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so we would need childcare. We would need, you know, a food, you know, area, a cafeteria type of area. And what that might look like, you know, it could be different depending on the location. But, you know, I want there to be full access and support for all of the individual's needs.
Which makes perfect sense, because if you don't have your basic Maslow's hierarchy, if you don't have your basic needs met, you can't pay attention to whether you like pipe fitting or not. You just show up bleary-eyed, do the thing, and leave. And I don't know if this is part of your model or not, but certainly even in my high school when I was growing up, there were spaces where students ran the businesses that supported the students, right? So like the auto shop students ran an auto shop, and students could get their cars fixed at the auto shop if it was simple enough, if they wanted, right? And so, you know, I hear you talking about food service and childcare, and I'm like, those are viable career options. Probably some students would gain
100%
valuable insight, not to necessarily entirely run it. You know, it would have to be run by somebody who was not rotating out after 7 weeks or whatever. But, you know, there's so much potential there for shared learning, for collaborative learning, for community. So when you think about this campus that you're creating and you think about the ways in which it's different from the more traditional top-down, you know, factory model educational piece, where do you see a shift in power distribution?
I want the, you know, it's funny, when I very, very first started my individual counseling business, I talked about putting students in the driver's seat. And I made actually a little video where I sat in my car behind my steering wheel and shot the video about it. Because I think that even with traditional high school to college planning, there's this idea that there's this force at work that's outside of everyone, and no one can really control it. It's sort of magic. And people get, adults, even parents, get caught up in this idea that, oh my gosh, you know, we can't do anything. We can't change anything. Yes, we can. And I want to shift the power so that the young people who are stepping out into their future have power, can say, you know what, I think that's a great idea, this, you know, this module over here for the trades, but I'm not interested in the trades. Fine. What are you interested in? And, you know, so that there's not this, you must, you have to, you know, things begin at this time and end at this time. Those are the only options. I want to shift everything so that young people feel that, you know, they can have a say in the, not only the things that they're being provided, but also in the direction that that takes and what that looks like and what it feels like. Because particularly the students that I am thinking will really be served best by this, you know, they've had the least power of all in our educational systems completely.
How do you think having agency changes the student experience?
I think it changes everything. Because when an individual feels, when a young person in particular, but I think all of us truthfully, feels that, you know, we have no stake, no, you know, we are not tied, you know, intrinsically to a process, to an experience, then we at some point feel that it is not ours. And, you know, when you, the more disconnect there is there, the less relatability, the less investment, there is on the part of the individual. And so, again, I think, you know, shifting it over to where, you know, this is for not just, you know, me as a as an outsider creating this campus, you know, poof, I magically created and, you know, and people come like Field of Dreams. I want this to develop from the community in a organic way so that there is investment from the place that it exists, not just from my mind.
That's an interesting phrase, you know, so that it develops from the place from which it exists and not just in your mind. And I think there's an interesting piece in there about the kind of power that you're taking on in this project and the ways in which you need to be really aware of your power and aware of the ways in which that could go very badly. Do you want to talk a little about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and to cut to the chase of it, or the quick of it, you know, I can't go into this project as a white savior. You know, I'm a middle-aged white woman with, you know, a graduate degree. I can't, you know, bulldoze my way into a community and, you know, build something and say, look, come. Instead, I need to go into a community and say, hey, what do you think about partnering with me and to build this, to create this? Is this something that would support you? Is this something that would support your children? Is this something that would support your business, whoever I'm talking to? Because I think the very easy thing to do is to, you know, is to, I'll build it and they'll come, that attitude, or I know best. I have ideas based on experiences, but I don't know best. I want to create something that is valuable to the people that it serves, not that is simply valuable to me.
So what do you think the early stages of power sharing are going to look like in your process? Eventually, of course, you're going to have an institution. But in the process of developing that institution, what are the early places where you're really looking closely at how to make sure that power rests in the community, even in the process of choosing a community? Because you haven't decided where you're locating this, have you?
I have not yet. No. So that is all part of it. You know, if I were to, I'm in Cleveland, Ohio right now. If I were to do it here, you know, I mean, I've already been in conversation with lots of people about this idea, about, you know, who it could serve. And I've talked to, you know, students, I've talked to business owners, I've talked to tradespeople, but I would prefer actually to locate this in another city. And in doing that, I'm going to have to create all the relationships that I have here somewhere else. And that's exactly what I need to do over the next couple of years, is go and meet and extend my hand and, you know, ask the questions, listen, you know, be in community with people who know the community.
So what you're really talking about is belonging.
Yes.
How do you find that belonging and power affect each other or balance each other out or strengthen or weaken each other?
I think, you know, I've always, you know, I grew up straddling a lot of different worlds. I grew up in an extremely rural community, which people always laugh at because I grew up in New Jersey and they don't think there are any rural communities there. But, you know, my entire life, there was no cable, as in cable television, that ran on my road. That didn't exist. It was too rural for the cable company to bother with our street. So, the coming from something that was isolated. And then as a young adult, I moved to a city, and I've lived in cities my entire adult life. I also come from two parents and an entire family that never went to college. So I also straddle those lines. And instead of looking at it as, you know, well, I'm a person who doesn't belong here, as in, for example, maybe I didn't feel like I first belonged in college. I just always looked for the connections, the places where I felt I fit in. And I sought to strengthen those whenever I could. And so I tried not to like look long and hard at the places where it was clear I didn't fit and didn't connect, but instead, you know, really say, okay, well, you know, here's some people who seem to be, you know, able to work with me. Let's see what we can do about connecting more deeply with those people. And, you know, I'm not going to ever be someone who grew up in an urban environment that I can't be that. And I can't be someone for whom higher education, for example, wasn't an option because it was something my family, even though they hadn't had it, focused on very seriously. But what I can do is say, okay, who already knows this and is willing to talk to me about it? And how do we then create something together? What are our shared values? What are our shared ideals? And I think that's, those are the pieces that I think I'm gonna have to focus on the most as I set out to find a location or to decide on a location. I have a short list, so.
So as you were talking, what I started to think about is what I think about as what I often frame in my mind as an access mindset, right? So there's a way in which having some kinds of privilege gave me an attitude or a mindset of access and a kind of entitlement, not entitlement in the way that we often use it, but entitlement in that I am entitled to have the system serve me. Mm-hmm. I'm entitled to succeed in this system. If I'm not succeeding in this system, something's wrong. The system is not functioning the way it should, and I'm going to fix it, which is, of course, not the experience for a lot of people. And I'm not entirely sure in retrospect that I was always right about that. But believing that, having that access mindset, allowed me to approach systems in a particular way where there's got to be a way for me to do this. I just have to find it.
Yes.
And as an adult moving through some of the social services systems and other systems that we have set up in this country, I've had a variety of experiences with that mindset. in school, it was pretty effective. In, you know, at the DMV, it's sometimes not as effective. And it's that delicate thing because you don't want to move into that place of negative entitlement, right? That place of everybody owes me something because that's just not the person that I want to be. And it's not the person most of the people I know want to be. But when we look at the range of possibilities and we think about, you know, this campus that you're creating, and we think about these conversations and we think about all the moving pieces that are involved, one of the things that I start to wonder is, how do you create that access mindset? How do you create the space for that access mindset? Because I'm imagining that some of the kinds of privilege that you did have allowed you the space that you needed to create it for yourself around some of the kinds of privilege you didn't have, say, as a first-generation college student.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering what kinds of things you think that you can do, or that one can do, or that a culture can foster to allow more people access to that mm-hmm. sense and the particular structures of thinking that go with it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when I even think about it for myself, you know, where did some of those things come from? And, you know, I mean, I was raised with a tremendous amount of support. And I think that's also what I think about when I consider this campus, this place, is I want there to be support because, you know, right now, I mean, Americans across the board are struggling in areas, things like healthcare, for example. You know, if you don't know how you're going to deal with, you know, an infection, or your child has a fever, how can you possibly focus on other things? But if you have support in this is how you can get assistance with this, you know, health issue, then you might feel like, oh, okay, I can breathe a little bit, and maybe now I can think about something else. So I see this sort of, I don't know, net or web of interconnected support systems that will sort of shore up, if you will, the feeling of just being cut off or free falling that I know that a lot of students that I've talked to have. You know, they don't think anyone is or anything is going to catch them if they fall, because that's been their experience, their lived experience. You know, I had a group of students tell me one time, everyone leaves us. You know, they get tired. You know, I was working in an after school program, and yeah, their experience had been, and they'd been in this after school program. They were in high school. They'd been in the program since they were in sixth grade. And they could tell me all the people that had left the program. I mean, they could name them all, and they could tell me things about them and when they left and why. And you know, and it was really, really difficult because, I mean, I certainly didn't think I was going to be retiring from that after school program. So I, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, well, what's going to make me any different? You know, I'm going to leave them too. And the only thing I could tell them was, you know, I may leave this role, but I don't have to leave you. You are worth investing in. You are worth continuing to be in relationship with. And you know, the only way, of course, that they, and I mean, I'm sure a lot of them didn't believe me when I said that. They wouldn't have any reason to believe me. So, you know, the only way to make that a reality and to show them that, you know, yes, you know, you do really have this support is to live it and to provide it ongoing. And I think with my campus idea, that's what I want, is there to be this safety net, this, you know, this place of, okay, you know, here you will be caught. You will not fall. We won't let you just disappear. You're not invisible.
You matter.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing you describe is community. And, you know, in some fantasy long ago world, in theory, we provided that for each other. And then in some dystopian fantasy world, we have abandoned it in favor of industrialization and capitalism. But I'm not actually sure that it's that clear cut, because communities have always abandoned people that they didn't find convenient.
Yes. And And a lot of people, I mean, in fact, I would hope that the bulk of the people that I want to serve are going to probably be the least convenient people in many ways.
And in many of the circles that I walk in, we have jokes about being the island of misfit toys.
Mm-hmm.
And that concept is so compelling for any of us who have been excluded. Because it's a place where everybody who's been excluded and everybody who understands that experience of exclusion comes together and forms a community informed by the trauma of exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in this fantasy ideal world, the trauma that we carry with us informs us not in a way to reproduce those patterns of trauma, although we know that brains do that, but in a way to encourage us to act in a different way, to change our patterns of behavior, to change the experience we've had so that other people don't have it. And so I think about this community within a community, because you're talking about going into a city community or a town community. And then within that city or town or region, you're talking about creating this smaller community and the smaller durable community. And the beauty of community in this model is that community provides continuity that individuals never can.
Right.
You can never promise you're not going to leave. You just can't. I mean, you can get hit by a bus.
Exactly.
And especially with people who have lost and lost and lost, if you promise them you're staying, they're going to look at you and go, fuck you. You can't promise that. I know you can't promise that. So just stop making it. And now I don't believe you when you say anything, because this is a completely unrealistic promise you just gave me. So instead, being able to say, I might leave, but the community will persist. I might leave, but here are the structures that are in place. I might leave, but you still have a place. You still have a home. You still have that longitudinal persistence is something that we provide in the same way that singers sing really, 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 really long notes in choirs.
Mm-hmm.
People who haven't sung in groups may not know this, but when there's an extremely long held note that just has to go on and on forever, what happens is that singers take catch breaths, but not all at the same time. So instead of hearing the entire choir go, you won't notice because singers are dropping out and taking a breath and coming back into the note and filling in for the people who are next who need to take breaths. And you don't even, as a choir, you don't even usually plan it out. You're not like, well, these three people and then those five people. You just trust that the inherent randomness of when you feel like you're running out of air will allow you to vary it enough that the overall sound is continuous.
Yes.
And that's the thing you're talking about here.
It's so many. Yeah, I love it.
So one of the interesting things that's emerging, you're my sixth interview. And one of the interesting things that's emerging as I'm doing these interviews is this pattern. I knew community was important. And I knew community was important. If you're a power holder, I knew community was important for holding you accountable. And we'll get to that because I think that's a really interesting conversation for someone in your particular role. But what's also interesting is that community is emerging as the locus of power.
Yes. I don't like to think that, you know, no individual can make change. I don't know if I believe that exactly, but I mean, when I think about the massive change that has occurred in the world and history at different times, it was never a person. It was maybe a person, who then said, hey, 300 friends of mine, let's start this, whatever. But no single solitary person is going it alone. Nobody goes it alone. And we to think that we are going it alone is such silliness, really. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. There's nothing about, unless you are, living off the grid and the land and, truly, and there are individuals, of course, who do that, but the rest of us are living in a, as I said, an interconnected web of support of all kinds. And, we don't think about all of those little pieces, but the more privilege you have, of course, the more access to that web you have, that network, and the less you have, the more holes there are in your web, in your connectivity. And I can't go and stitch up all the holes for every individual I ever encounter, sadly. but perhaps if I gather enough community, we can create a stronger web under a group of people in a community, as a community.
I don't know that access is that to the web is that simple, because I know a lot of people who are privilege compromised in one way or another and have incredible networks. And in fact, the network is why they're not dead, literally why they're not dead.
Right.
So I think that sometimes stress connects us. Stress forces us to recognize that we never roll solo. And I would even say those people who live out in the woods are connected to an interconnected web of all existence. But their interdependent web of all existence is like squirrels and trees and fewer humans. But to forget that humans are only a little piece, I think is, well, Australia is on fire. And I think about the kind of hubris that's necessary to think that you don't need a network, that you don't need other people, that you don't need individuals. Like that's, I understand
special from a trauma kind of insanity.
Well, I understand from a trauma perspective, especially if people have continually left or continually hurt you, at some point you curl into a little ball and you're like, okay, fine, I'm going to do it all myself because everything else is dangerous. So I get where it comes from, but mm-hmm. I also think that in so many places in our society, we see people deciding that they can do it all alone or trying to decide that they can do it all alone. And especially if you have a new idea, especially if you're out front running with this thing that nobody's ever seen or heard before, and you're surrounded by people who are telling you it can't be done. And here you are saying, excuse me, I'm busy doing it. Hold that thought. Right. You have to be able to do that. You have to say, excuse me, I'm busy. And in so doing, you have to create distance between yourself and the people who say you can't or shouldn't do something. However, when you do that, what you do is you end up isolated. You end up without the community that you need. And so my contention over and over in these interviews, my contention is that as innovators, as disruptors, as people out front, as intensives, we have a moral and ethical responsibility to gather communities of our own around us and communities that are ethically engaged, communities that are engaged with making the world a better place, because it is so possible to start out saying, excuse me, I'm busy, end up being like, yeah, all those people are just collateral damage.
Right. No, I think you're 100% correct. And I as an intensive and also, my four tendencies, which is Gretchen Rubin's model of what motivates me, which is nothing motivates me. I motivate me only when I feel like being motivated. So rebel personality. And that can get very, I don't care about you. I'm doing what I feel like doing when I feel like doing it. And I think, as I've gotten older, which I sometimes hate saying those words in that way, but it's true. As a younger person, I often fell into the trap of, well, I will show you what I can do. You don't think I can do it. I will show you. And I think now my response is more, well, wait a minute. Okay. So you don't think I can do this, or you don't think it's a good idea to do it. Tell me more about that. Why? And not that I'm going to, quote, win everyone over, but there are lessons to be learned in there too. I've had a couple of people say some things to me about this project already that really got me thinking about it in a different way, from a different angle. You and I talked about, whether it could be a for-profit or not-for-profit. And I also spoke to a friend who's a not-for-profit attorney and had a really long conversation with them about it. And, it actually, the two of you changed my mindset on that, which, is not easily done sometimes. So that was, even things like that, I think there's value in having conversation, even with the people who say you can't do it or it's not worth doing.
Yes, I think there's often, assuming those people are in good faith, I think there's often value in those conversations. Yeah. And also there's a moment where you have to be like, okay, I've had enough. That's enough. I hear you. I understand what you're saying. And I'm going to go do this thing over here. And you, if you don't think you want to come with me, that's a completely legitimate decision, but I'm going to be over here. And, yeah. And so then at that moment, I think I'm interested in how we select or how we create or how we gather and how we prioritize selecting or creating or gathering these people. Because I can tell you, I live in startup world out here in the Bay. And when you're starting a company, a tech company that's supposed to become a, you know, unicorn company and make whatever millions of dollars in whatever short, in extremely short runway to keep your investors happy, right? The thing that's right in front of you is I have to bring this concept to market. I have to market it and I have to sell it. And often they don't even remember the marketing and selling part. They're just like, I have to create the thing. I need a viable, minimum viable product. And then I have to create the thing. And then I'm go, 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 go. And it feels like frivolousness to take the time to be in community with, for example, other founders. People are like, I don't have time to talk to founders. Why would I talk to them? They're not working on my product. I'm not working on their product. And so I'm interested in the ways in which we choose the people and in the ways that we gather those communities and then in the ways that we prioritize being present to those communities. I mean, we see it in ministry too, where we're supposed to have collegial gatherings. Now, we have a code of conduct that includes being in relationship with one another. And sometimes I think that's the only thing that keeps us coming to collegial gatherings because we all feel overwhelmed. We all feel busy. It's hard to get there.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. And I worked in higher education for a number of years, and I distinctly recall more than once being in a meeting where we were, you know, developing something, a new plan for something. And, you know, I would ever so slowly raise my hand and say, have we considered the impact on the students with this? And I would, it was always amazing to me when I said that, the blank looks I would sometimes get. And I'd be like, well, you know, just a little reminder that we're a university and we don't actually exist without students. So
you're so picky.
but this is what happens. I mean, you know, people, I mean, higher education, I mean, at least the places that I worked were all, quote, not for profit. But I mean, everything was driven by enrollment and income, everything. So even in those cases, I mean, I think that you have to have, that's, I think, part of your power balance is having the people, and I'm not suggesting that I'm this person in this case, but I need the people that are going to say, Kimberly, what about these students? What about this 22-year-old over here? And, you know, hopefully, in fact, a 22-year-old themselves saying, yeah, that doesn't work for me. So there has to be, in order to create something, and again, it is a community ultimately, not just I call it a campus, but it really is a community. In order to create it and have it thrive, there has to be a full balance so that there is no, you know, there may be my signature on some paperwork, but there can't be only my voice in any meeting or any space, because then I'm just listening to my own echo.
Right. And I think that's really important to have systems of accountability built into the institution, right? If you're a founder of a company, then it's often you need to have 360 feedback systems or something like right. that. And if you're in a nonprofit institution, it can be a little bit different. It depends on what kind of nonprofit you're in or what kind of, you know, every company has its own, or every organization has its own structures for internal feedback, kind of up and down the power structure, because yeah. almost always there are people at the top, whatever that means, making the final decisions where the buck stops. And those positions can be particularly isolating. And that's why people hire coaches, right? That's why you end up with CEOs yeah. with executive coaches, because that's somebody who's outside the power structure entirely. I mean, yes, the CEO can fire you as a coach, but if you're hiring me to make sure that somebody tells you when you're messing up, it doesn't make sense right. to fire me when you're messing up. And if you do, then you're not a good fit for me as a right. As your exactly. coach. Like I cannot coach or consult with somebody who's just going to kick me out if I say something they don't like. But in addition to systems of one-on-one systems of accountability, you know, at that kind of peer level, I think there's something really, really important about being in community with other leaders, you know, and some of my understanding of this really is informed by those collegial gatherings, by those clergy collegial gatherings. And they're still dicey, you know, we're still in an institution. We still have power imbalances, even within those gatherings, you know, senior ministers and junior ministers and ministers with enormous congregations and ministers with no congregation at all, or, you know, and so there, it's not like it's a perfect system, but if you're, I'm really coming to this place of if you're starting a new thing, you need to be in community with other people who are also starting new things. You need to be in a really, truly in a community of your peers, because mm-hmm. at some point, for example, that 22-year-old you're talking about, right? That 22-year-old is in your institution.
Right.
And that A creates a power imbalance. There's no mm-hmm. way it doesn't. But right. B, there are things that are your responsibility as a high-level leader in that institution that you cannot discuss, frankly, with a rank-and-file member of that institution.
Right.
You just can't. And no, that's the reality of human behavior.
It's not their burden to bear.
It's not only not their burden to bear, it's also sometimes you have things to say that, because as a leader, your job is the welfare of the entire institution.
Right.
And sometimes, even with the most rigorous ethical and moral standards, there is still going to be some kind of collateral damage. You're going to have to take a hit over here in order to keep that from completely tanking. Right.
Of course, yes.
And you can't say that to the stakeholders in those pieces of the institution most of the time.
Right. No, that's true.
Our culture has not provided us with the robustness of personal development necessary to sit in front of a leader who's saying to you, listen, I know this is going to mean that you can't continue in the institution, but for the good of the institution, I still have to make this decision.
Yeah.
And not take it personally. Like the amount of personal development and solidity and security in other parts of their lives. And you're talking about people who probably don't have a lot of other security in a lot of cases. Right, exactly. Like the number of personal resources you have to be in that conversation and be in it in a way that's not damaging to you is just too great. So you can't have that conversation with that person. You can have that conversation with your coach. And you can have that conversation with a peer group if you have a peer group.
Right. Yeah. So it's, I mean, it is taking the time and nurturing a group of peers, of people doing, you know, similar types of work in, you know, other communities or in the same community if that's available. But yeah, it's going to be a critical part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see over the next, I don't know, 10, 15 years where we go with this. Because, you know, we've been watching for some time. We've been watching, you know, Uber and WeWork and Tesla. And like, there's a pattern here, right? There's a pattern here. And it's led by intensives. Those of us who start new shit cannot look at that and be like, oh no, you know, Elon Musk is definitely an expansive. Elon Musk is so intensive. And he's one of those people that folks are like, well, he's a genius. Not sure I'd want to be a genius like that though. Right?
Yeah.
And there's this kind of de facto community that rises up. And so how do you keep from being in a de facto community, you know, in social services and education and in those kinds of fields, the de facto community is often cynical and a little bit bitter.
Yeah.
So what do you need as a rising leader to have a different kind of community?
You know, I mean, I think that I have to seek out people who are not just doing these things, but who share the, you know, I have a friend who says her optimism is like, she's like a bubble. She floats up naturally. And I said, that's not my optimism. I said, my optimism, and I've described it like this my whole adult life, it's relentless. So my optimism is, okay, yeah, no, we're going to take that hit, but we are going to keep going once we take that hit. I don't just buoy, I don't float. I definitely do not. It's not my nature. But although I do appreciate it in my friend, it's such a beautiful quality to be around. But it's not my innate nature. And I think back to my very first social work job. I was a domestic violence counselor and rape crisis counselor. We manned a hotline and we had a shelter. And, you know, women, we primarily served women who were being physically abused or assaulted in some way. And, you know, many, many times those women would seek shelter and then they would leave and they would often return to their abusive environment for a variety of reasons. And, you know, I was 23, right around there. And, you know, it was so hard to understand, not so much why. I understood the why, but, you know, in my mind, it seemed like, well, we should do more. You know, our work should do more to support the women so that this didn't happen. And I remember my boss, she'd immigrated from India, and she was, you know, I'm 6 feet tall. I think Terry was probably 4'11", but she had this presence. And she said to me, well, you know, that is the work, you know? And she said the average woman will leave, 7 times before she leaves for good. And she said, you know, when they go back, she said, then we look for the next time. And she said, and we see it as one more time toward the 7. We are getting closer to the 7. And she said it with such conviction. And, you know, she'd been in social work many years, and she told me she'd had clients who died. You know, I mean, things, you know, we lost 2 clients in the years I was in domestic violence. And I, you know, they were horrible, but that idea that, you know, we're moving closer. It's not perfect. We cannot fix everything. We cannot mend every hole. But we are not going to give up, and we're going to keep moving forward. That's, I think, the mindset that I have to align myself with other people doing this, you know, these types of things. And I don't want to connect with other people who are, you know, magically fixing everything. And I don't want to connect with people who, you know, aren't in it for the long haul, aren't in it for, you know, forever.
Mm-hmm. Aren't in justice work or aren't in their particular project or.
I think in justice work. I mean, long-term, you and I have talked about this. I mean, long-term, you know, my dream for this type of community would be that it isn't just in the one location that I choose, that it can be in ultimately multiple locations, that the model can be duplicated, and, you know, and again, grow in different communities and suit that community's needs best. But, you know, am I going to promise anyone that I will forever be connected to this. I can't do that, because maybe there will be something else that will be something that I need to do. But I am committed to this and to creating this and creating it, making sure that I, again, I'm not, that it isn't about me. So that if I am ultimately connected to it or not, that it continues to thrive, because it isn't me. It's its own thing.
Right. Right. I mean, it reminds me of One Last Time from Hamilton, that song, right? Where Washington is like, if I step down now and I don't run again, then the country learns that it's like its own institution. It's not a cult of personality.
Yeah.
And if I don't step down, that doesn't happen.
Right.
It sort of blows my mind to think about the ways in which, you know, for all the terrible, terrible atrocities that were committed around the American Revolution, it blows my mind to think about the ways in which reconfiguring concepts of national leadership transformed everything and influenced everything in that moment in history.
Yeah.
And the ways in which we understand our institutions to be separate from ourselves. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, in church, I essentially restarted the youth group from scratch. It had come apart and lost momentum for a variety of reasons, partially institutional, partially just, you know, sometimes four-year institutions made of students cycle through. And with the support and with the inspiration from other youth in other places, I restarted the group. And I had, again, privilege. I had access. I had a very, very supportive board president with an enormous amount of clout, who later went on to be the moderator of the Unitarian Universalist Association. But I didn't really know how much clout she had at the time. All I knew was that she was the board president and she thought youth things should happen. And she was delighted. She had been waiting basically to find somebody to back, because she was like, this has to come out of the youth. So I can't make it happen. But as soon as I showed up and like whispered a whisper of possibly being interested in leadership, she was like, I'm on it. And she was so good about supporting me. Her name was Denny Davidoff, and she died a number of years ago. But she was a real treasure for me in a lot of ways. Problematic in other ways, but a real treasure for me in a lot of ways. And she, you know, she provided that kind of institutional support that I needed. But I started the youth group from scratch. It was my baby. And I realized as I moved up into my junior year that if I didn't put some kind of succession plan in place, it was going to die as fast as it had started.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I don't know where I don't know how I figured that out, because I was like a depressed 16-year-old. But somehow, and you know, a lot of brilliant 16-year-olds have done a lot of brilliant things, but I don't think I'm that extraordinary. But what happened was I came up into this position of leadership. I looked at the way that I had arrived there and at what I wanted to leave behind. And I was like, oh shit, this, my junior year, needs to be my last year of really solid leadership. Next year, I need to be mentoring people. I need to be stepping down. I need to already be on my way out before I leave. And learning to understand that and to let go of these like precious creations of our hearts, because they're so precious to us. I mean, I'm not a parent, but I always think it must be a little bit like parenting, because you create this thing and it's precious and you have this vision, and the more it grows, the less it does what you expected it to do. And then at some point you have to be like, this is not mine anymore. It's its own thing. And I have to trust that I've created enough structures and enough institutional support that when I step away, it doesn't fall over. And so no, I think
it's a very apt analogy.
And I think that the ways in which we as leaders make sure that we are in community with other leaders helps us in that, because when we're in community with other leaders, then we're also able to maintain that differentiation. I am a person in this gathering of other people who each have their own institutions that they're shepherding.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's that institution. It's that institution over there. I am here. That institution is over there. It matters to me. I'm engaged with it. It is not me.
Right.
Because we can't afford to have it be us.
Yes, for many, many reasons.
So many reasons. mental health is one of them. It like I literally, when things aren't going well in my business and I've forgotten that I and my business are not the same thing, I feel terrible about myself.
Yeah.
And the only salvation for that is for me to do things that are not business related.
Yes.
You know, like I sell my art, but it's not really a business. It's a sideline. And so I'll go make art. Mm-hmm. Or I'll get involved in a conversation with somebody that has nothing to do with anything. Or I'll go into the park and stare at the trees. And sometimes I think about business when I'm doing that, but I'm aware that I'm not in my business when I'm doing that.
Right. Well, I use this analogy with my students a lot. And it's very true for us as well, is that, you know, I say to them when they say, well, you know, I'm not good at school, or I'm not, you know, I haven't been successful, and therefore, you know, like what use am I? And I was like, think about the people that love you most in the world, that you know, they're your people, you know, your heart connections, you know, whoever those people are. And when I think about them, none of the people that are my people, that are my heart connections, not a single one of them cares what I do for a living. None of them. They're not interested in my expertise in those areas whatsoever. Not at all. They love me for me. And that's the crux of it, you know. That's what I tell my students, you know, your people do not love you for your, you know, grade in biology. They just really don't care.
At root, love is not transactional.
Correct.
If it's transactional, it's not actually love. It's something else, which is fine, but it's not love. And when you find love in whatever form, romantic love, filial love, you know, platonic love, when you find love, you realize, I tell people this all the time and they look at me and then they go, oh, you realize that love isn't something you can deserve. It's too big.
Right.
It's too big. Yes. There's no way you can be a person who deserves love. The only thing you can do is accept it with gratitude, to receive love, knowing that it's this enormous gift that you couldn't possibly have deserved. It's like it's outside the realm of deserving. It's outside the realm of transaction.
Yeah, you're right.
And when you realize that you can't deserve it, then you can release yourself from trying to be good enough to deserve it.
Yes.
So we are coming to the end of our hour. Do you have any final words about power and community and your work? Anything you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I am not sure that there's anything additional that I could say that I really feel that I haven't said, to be honest. I feel like in terms of community and, as I say, you know, this idea of creating, you know, a net of people, you know, of not leaving people behind, that's something that, you know, is what I want to step into. And yes, I will hold power in this experience, but it is not my thing. I will not own it, and I will, you know, I I'm looking to, you know, to build it alongside other people.
And where can they find you if they're interested in supporting your project, supporting your work, hearing more from what you're doing?
They can find me right now at ksaeducationalconsulting.com.
Okay. ksaeducationalconsulting.com, and that's a URL.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. And do you have a name for your new project yet? Do you have a working title, or are you just calling it The Canvas?
The working title that I have has been Another Road. And I'm coming up against there already exist some things with that name. Mm-hmm. So I'm mulling that over right now, but that's been my working title, Another Road.
And are you in a position now to accept contributions? Are you looking for other kinds of support? What can people do to support the work that you're doing? Or should they just get in touch with you?
People can certainly get in touch with me. And yes, I am. I'm actually this year will be making my first trips to start scouting locations and talking to people in different spaces. So I welcome, you know, all types of support in that. And there will be, I'm hoping to have a campus donated, but there will certainly be expenses, related to the creation of the campus that is needed. So absolutely, I would love for people to get in touch with me.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
This has been the Power Pivot podcast. We've been talking with Kimberly Shepherd, the Teen Whisperer, who is starting an exciting new campus-based project, which will combine community and educational opportunities for young people, especially those who have struggled in the more conventional educational systems.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Power Pivot. We'd love to hear from you. Please rate and subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support Power Pivot and get early access to new episodes, go to intensivesinstitute.com/Patreon. For information about coaching and consulting, or to book Lila for a talk or workshop, go to intensivesinstitute.com.